Hello, everyone. Welcome to Pterodactyl, another episode, and welcome to me, Galen O'Connor, another host. The same host. I mean, I was trying to be wordy. It's episode 21, and on this episode I interviewed Chelsea Sexton. Now, I did this interview a while back, to be quite honest and frank. But I haven't done this because of things in life. Basically, I was working at Arby's full time, and that job just fucking... It was full time. Fast food customers are like the devil and vultures and the boogeyman and monsters all wrapped up into one, and I'm so glad I quit that job. I am down to a 20-hour a week job now. I'm working for the university at a job, and it's fine because I'm in an apartment. I moved into this new apartment back in May that is only $525 a month. But this podcast isn't about rental prices. It's about electric vehicles. I just wanted to let you know what was going on in my life and why I haven't done an episode of this podcast since February. February. That's why. Now, things are great. I am in class, getting A's on all of my assignments. I'm going to class, seeing people in the flesh, in person. I'm able to ask my questions in a manner befitting expediency. I raise my hand and I ask a question and it gets answered immediately. I don't have to send a fucking email. I don't have to wait around on Canvas for some bullshit message. I just ask a question. And I get to know my professors as human beings, and I get to know the people on my teams as human beings, rather than trying to decipher tonal inflections from emails and fucking Canvas. How I will never, ever miss online courses ever again. Fuck them. They suck. If they're good for you, that's great. But for me, it brought down my GPA considerably. I'm sitting at a... Goddamn. Anyways. What was I talking about? Oh yeah, electric vehicles. The cars are the thing. The cars move us not only in body, but in soul. We are passengers to a journey of love, of passion, life, of joy and pain, or happiness and sadness. Our lives are built in cars. Cars drive us, and we drive cars. Chelsea Sexton loves cars. She loved cars, and she sold cars. Her passion and commitment were the fire of her phoenix. 25 years ago, in 1996, the EV1 was designed and manufactured by General Motors in California. Only a short time later, its charbroiled carcass was being circled by vultures in the desert wastes of the American Southwest. And the Chelsea Sexton, the iteration of Chelsea that we know today, was birthed from its flames. Chelsea went on to become an electric vehicle advocate, co-founding the organization Plug in America, and being the voice of reason
and passion for many. Chelsea, welcome to Pterodactyl, and let me ask you a very important question, the first thing on everyone's mind. Mel Gibson, has that aged well?
Well, first I'll say that is the most poetic introduction I have ever heard. Second, yes, Mel was, actually he was always delightful to me and very polite, but he had his summer of love right as the movie was coming out. So yes, it made for interesting Q&A sessions at every screening.
Okay, let's rewind a little bit. Who Killed the Electric Car was a documentary that probably made you some sort of name. Before that, like, what was your life before that versus when the movie came out and when people said, oh, hey, who's, is that girl?
Well, ironically, I am one of the most shy and introverted people in our industry and movement. So I worked all through the EV1 years, and I mean, I'd been doing EVs for a decade before the film came out, and mostly anonymously, as I would prefer it. When we did the vigil in front of Burbank, a few reporters caught on to the fact that a former GM employee was in the mix. But most of, generally speaking, other than a few articles, most people didn't realize. And Chris Payne had been working on the movie. We sat down when he started it. We'd held the funeral as an attempt to bring other people to tell the story. We knew it was kind of a last-ditch PR stunt, but we figured, like, where's Frontline PBS? Somebody like that would come and tell this story, even if they thought we were the weird ones. And they didn't. And so that's when he, after the funeral, he sort of went, well, maybe I'll try to make it myself. And we sat down, we had a long conversation about who could be involved. And I told him then, I'm happy to help, but I don't want to be in your movie. And he said, that's great. I don't want you in my movie. I was one of the people from LA that was not seeking to be on screen. And so we worked on this thing off and on for like 5 years. And he was filming in the background of all the activities, but I paid him no attention whatsoever because we sort of had this agreement. And I saw a rough cut of the movie and I wasn't in it. We had at the very end of the process, we'd filmed a little bit in my mother's kitchen. You can see the olive oil bottles in the background and stuff because I started EV1 out of my bedroom in my parents' house at the age of 20. And so we did this little interview, but mostly they said, man, we want time to use it. We have 300 hours of good footage. And of course, being utterly gullible, I believed them. And I saw a rough cut and I wasn't in it, and that was great. And then we went to Sundance and we saw for the first time the closest version to what everybody else has seen. It was about 80% correct. And my husband's sitting next to me going, oh my God, your head is so big, as we both stared at this giant movie theater screen. And the funny thing is, he's in it too, and actually has been recognized more than I have. But no one puts together that we were married as two characters in the movie.
Oh, wow.
So he's the technician at the end of the film that with the clean hands that demonstrates all the parts that EVs don't use.
So they did Chris trick you?
No. Well, no, I don't think so. It's not like trickery.
Surprise.
It was a surprise. It wasn't trickery on Chris's part at all, I don't think. It was, you know, obviously I sat in front of a camera, just I didn't expect it to actually be used in the end. And the process of these things is that you film everything and then you put together different pieces. You see how it goes. Obviously the rough cut they decided needed some changes. And so I wasn't in it then, but I became in it later. And if we're all honest and candid with each other, I helped balance a little bit of the middle-aged white guy talking heads of that first movie. So there's a little bit of balance and color to it that way. And I think some of the emotional passion, human interest aspect, because I was closer to it than the other characters. Ironically, Chris Payne and Dean Devlin, who was our executive producer, were both EV1 customers of mine. That's sort of how this also got started, but neither of them were visible on screen. So there wasn't an emotional tie to the car, except through me primarily.
And now, not very long later, after we all thought the car was dead, that's why the title was Who Killed the Electric Car, there's over 70 electric vehicles around the world that you can buy, not necessarily here in the United States, but wow.
Yeah, although, I mean, not that long, depends on your frame of reference. The movie came out 15 years ago. So it has been a little bit of time, but yes, it is very encouraging to see what's happening now, for sure.
What year was it when you realized that the car wasn't dead, that it was coming back? I see you've got Revenge of the Electric Car on the wall behind you.
Yes. Ironically, we started to hear about the cars coming back while we were doing the press tour for Who Killed. So we went to Sundance in January of 2006. Did I get, 2006. God, it is that long ago. And then we did the classic Sony press tour through that sort of winter, spring. And the dynamic is generally you fly into a city, you do a screening that evening, you do some press in that city the next morning, and then you fly to the next one. And we were in Minneapolis when a reporter called me. I'm standing on a street corner. I get this phone call from a reporter, and she goes, "What do you think about GM doing another electric car?" And I proceeded to tell this poor woman that she probably ought to lay off the hard drugs, because there was no way GM was going to do another EV. But 6 months later, GM is unveiling the Saturn plug-in hybrid SUV at the LA Auto Show. And GM unfortunately had to watch the press call Chris and I for comment, like, "What do you think about these plans?" And GM finally went, "Okay, fine, we're not going to get rid of these people. We should engage with them." And so they called us up and they said, "Well, if you liked what you saw in Los Angeles, you should come to the Detroit Auto Show." And we kind of went, yeah, sure. Like, show me, don't tell me. We're not going to Detroit from Los Angeles on your say so. And so they actually flew us out to Washington, D.C. in December of 2006. And we met at like a McCormick and Schmick's in some corner booth. It was like the proverbial smoky room image. And it was six GM executives, Chris Payne, me, and a laptop, basically. And so they showed us the Volt for the first time before the show in order to entice us, like, "No, we're serious with this car. Come to the Detroit Auto Show and we'll unveil it for real." And so at the time, we weren't even thinking about a second film at all. But we thought, okay, fine, we'll at least show up to the show and see if they are for real and talk to them. And Chris brought a camera, just in case. And that ended up being the first shoot for the second film, Revenge of the Electric Car. And in his mind, like, once we made a murder mystery with Who Killed, he had to make a monster movie. So Revenge.
You and the gang, the team, I don't know if Dean was involved in the second one, was he?
He was not.
Okay.
So he was supportive, but he wasn't as directly involved.
You've made documentaries about electric vehicles or been a part of them. There are other documentaries out there that are not so positively viewed. They do not.
With it. Just like, candor's good. Spit it out.
Okay. Planet of the Humans.
I have not seen it.
Oh my God. I don't get how someone can get that so wrong. I guess that leads me into the question of there's derision in our society, but derision based on what we all think is science. Whoever said that we are scientists, we're not. We have to interpret abstracts on an individual basis, but we can't do all of the observations and experimentation to create something that is actually scientifically sound. So we have to interpret based on our own experiences as individuals what the abstract means. And that's what a lot of us have to do. So you're left with multiple understandings of what the abstract means, of multiple interpretations, because anybody can read five words and come with away with a different understanding of it. Like, the religious texts of the world. Well, if you look at a scientific abstract saying that so many kilowatt hours will power a vehicle for so many lengths of time, right? You may not think that is going to create a paradigm, but different people take away different understandings from the same fact.
I think science is... real science, peer-reviewed science, is pretty indisputable. And I get that people will draw different interpretations based on those facts, depending on their agenda. But generally speaking, the science is more objective. I think in the case of documentaries, many of them have a point of view. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing unless you obscure that fact. And same thing, frankly, with writing and with sort of quote journalism, which, I mean, I write articles when something gets under my skin. I never call myself a journalist because that is a more specific, that's more science oriented, that's more objective oriented. But you can have, you can be a writer and you can do op-eds or, you know, contextual pieces. And as long as you put it out there where you're coming from, that's not a big deal. And so Who Killed the Electric Car came out at a time when documentaries had still been mostly coming from kind of the PBS frontline style. And so having a point of view was still really early in that time. And we got a lot of flack for it because it did. At the same time, we didn't pretend otherwise. And I think that's the point. So we had a point of view. Obviously, there were lots of EV fans out there. And the thing that resonated with me the most and still does is that I have never heard from a single person involved in one of the EV programs of that era that, or anyone in the film for that matter, that said that we were biased or unbalanced or unfair in our portrayal, anything like that. So, I mean, even if we had to pick a villain at General Motors at the time, that particular person called me up and he goes, I got to tell you, it was bittersweet to watch, but it was fair and balanced. And so the fact that we couldn't get criticism from the people that were actually involved was very heartening. And to this day, I still get notes from people that were involved in EV1 or one of the other programs, because there were six or seven of them in that generation, many of whom were sort of put out to pasture professionally in the wake of those programs because they were deemed to be associated with something failed. And when that movie came out and ever since, a lot of that work has been redeemed in their companies and in their minds and with their peers. And so that engendering of respect for what was really stupendous engineering at the time and a lot of really great effort, I think is both warranted, it's timely, and it continues to move forward. So storytelling is not a bad thing as long as you're honest about where you're coming from.
But there's this pervasion of this mindset in society. And I believe that it was paid for by the oil lobby, but it has just ingrained itself into normal people. So much so that the other night I was having a conversation with a coworker. And of course, we work at a truck stop. I'm sorry, but I need a job, right? I need money. That's the death knell of capitalism. I work at the fast food joint at the truck stop, and she works at the counter at the truck stop stand where she sells petroleum products. I'm sorry. We got into this heated conversation about how, and I can understand where she's coming from. She says that electric vehicles, if we all drove them, it would ruin our economy because our economy is based on oil products. And I'm like, sending her all of these studies that say it's more than just the thing you're selling. It's about the society you're living in, the air you're breathing, the nauseous fumes that are affecting your development as a child. What is a definitive statement that I can just say? Like, is there one thing that I can say to convince somebody that it's better?
Well, I think there's lots of things that go to it being better. I would say at a microscopic level, the profit for petroleum retailers is not made on the fuel. It's made on exactly what you sell. It's made on the amenities. So if she's talking about, you know, it's going to kill our economy because gas stations, I mean, truck stop is a glorified gas station. All of the facts are otherwise. No retailer is making the money on the fuel itself. It's making the money on the snacks and the amenities, things like that. And it's to the point that even Shell in Europe has said out loud, look, we actually make more profit when we do charging. We make more profit on the charging than we do on petrol or diesel. So, you know, aside from the fact that the amenities and the snacks are actually the biggest source of profit, electric vehicle charging actually makes us more money than selling liquid fuels. So there's that. But there's also the absolute reality that cars in general, and I don't care if they're propelled by electricity or otherwise, but also certainly petroleum as a fuel does not pay its fair share and does not incur the cost of its externalities. So that is a much bigger thornier issue to address, but it's also absolute fact. So you're not going to convince everybody. And certainly, you know, I get it that in her spots, you know, she's thinking I might not have a job if everybody goes electric. And those are real human concerns that are valid. They may not bear out in the long run, but it is fair for people to have these concerns about, okay, if we switch to electricity or if we switch to automation or if we switch to whatever technology, what does that mean for me? That's the most human thing. How do I pay my own rent? And that's fine. And that does require more, you know, sympathy and ongoing conversation. And also when people are open to it, data to back it up. But there is no silver bullet to convince all the naysayers, to cut to the chase.
You brought up that Shell makes money off of charging. And that's, this is something that I've been thinking about recently. I posted it to my LinkedIn and I swore a couple of times. I swore a lot of the fucking time, but there are barriers to entry for lower income individuals.
Absolutely.
And one of them that I didn't even realize was a barrier to entry until I got my $2,300 used Nissan Leaf off of Craigslist with a
nice job,
degraded battery pack. So I can only get 30 miles, but hey, it's still a Leaf. I noticed that both Electrify America and Green Lots, if you're going to be using Chatamo, you have to click on a specific button in the app, which this is preload $10 a time, or else they take $50 as a pre-authorization. And to a lot of people, that's fine, especially to the early adopters of brand new electric vehicles, because hey, they can afford it. But say, and this is a big part about my thinking, say you don't have a phone, say you can't pay for your phone plan, how the hell are you going to get here from here to there? And say you don't actually have the $50 to pre-authorize, say you have $20, which is perfectly enough to get home, but you can't fucking get there because you can't pre-authorize. That's, in my mind, a barrier to entry for lower-income individuals.
That is one of several barriers to entry for lower-income people, no question. I mean, used car financing rates are another. There are a variety of them, and while they get a lot of talk, they are complex issues to solve. Just, I mean, the number of people who live in multi-unit, multi-family apartment buildings, we call them by lots of things, but basically that is another one. Not everyone can charge at home. Some of these buildings have some parking we can put charging in, some don't. And so we try to do things like workplace charging and public charging and stuff to help accommodate. But there's no question that there is also the unbanked, those without smartphones. Apps are useful for many, but not for all. And you know, any single network is unlikely to solve all of the problems. Electrify America is also uniquely bound by the settlement terms, which say specifically that they are not allowed to undercut competitors with their costs. So they're not allowed to be significantly cheaper than EVgo or ChargePoint or GreenLots or anybody else from a competitive standpoint. And that is baked into the actual settlement. So on one hand, I understand all the flack, but I also have to at least defend them on that one factual point of they're not allowed. That doesn't change the fact that lots of public charging is unaffordable to rely on completely. And that, I mean, that ends up being that we rely on things like PlugShare, which is more agnostic to networks. and you can plug in your needs, but you can search out all the free chargers that way that work with your car, things like that. So yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. These are issues, and there are some solutions, and they work better in some places more than others. Some cities have more charging than others. All of those things are true. And it's part of the reason we all have to keep working at it. On one hand, lots of great things are happening with EVs these days. And I hear a lot of people going, oh, that's great. Rolling snowball can't be stopped. We can all go off on holiday now. And I'm one of the people going, no, 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 there's so much work yet to be done. And topics like this are among those. No question.
What Robert says, or Bobby, as those who can't speak Welsh.
Robert Llewellyn, yes.
Or spell Welsh. I don't know where the L's go and the Y's go. Sorry.
It's all good.
It's a joke. It's a joke. He says as many times as he can, electric vehicles aren't going to save the world.
Not single-handedly, no.
Even though they're better, right? If everyone switched over, we'll still have congestion. We'll still have parking times. It takes 30 minutes in general in a big city to find parking. And that's why I'm more geared toward the idea that there are three revolutions happening at the same time. And you've heard of this phrase, three revolutions. It's actually an organization. The
conference is actually happening today.
If we're speaking to transportation planners, what is the most fundamental aspect that has to be considered for the future? Is it people, like the amount of people? Is it carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? Is it getting from here to there? Just what idea, what is the fundament?
Well, so to go back and explain the three revolutions, and this is expressed in a variety of ways, but it all, and there's lots of acronyms in different orders, but it mostly comes down to electric, autonomous, and shared are the three revolutions that are expected to come. And the timing on each of those are different. Certainly electric and shared are emerging now. Autonomous, a little bit longer term, but that's also somewhat different than the conversation I would have with transit planners and generally speaking, one of the bigger frustrations of the moment is that EVs have become conflated with private cars. Electric vehicles come in all forms, from scooters to class 8 semi-trucks for long haul. I mean, port electrification, truck stop electrification has been going on for years. All of these things are all valid, and especially transit. So transportation planners are meant to serve people, not cars. And a significant need going forward is to reduce car dependency. And in some places that looks like a ban cars movement, but really reducing dependency just means providing other options. It's not a matter of saying you can't have a car. It is saying, here's some other great options we can provide for those that want to take them. Whether that is appropriate infrastructure for bikes and scooters, actual lanes that are dedicated so they're not trying to compete with a Suburban on a major thoroughfare, or better transit. And certainly they have been incredibly underfunded forever, rather than saying we just want to fund EVs in the form of more Teslas. I get the frustration around that. And there's a place for encouraging adoption of, if you're going to have cars, make them electric cars. But the goal should be replacing all fossil fuels with electrons in any kind of vehicle we possibly can. For transit planners and transportation planners in urban areas, decrease car primacy. Don't make the car the center of your planning. Make people the center of your planning. Make getting around the center of your planning. Make mobility the center of your planning. Make quality of life the center of your planning. Affordability, all of those things matter more than make it easy for someone in their car to get around.
So not necessarily just converting to electric, but also a bucket with a little damp rag in it to clean up the urine on the seats in the subway would be real nice.
Yes, that's different than electric transportation, but it certainly facilitates transit.
Just a metaphor.
And there are those solutions as well. Motivo makes a specific motorized autonomous device that runs around and disinfects planes and transits and things like that.
Now we're on to the subject of autonomy. And last year at CES, I didn't do the virtual CES this year because
You didn't miss much.
I didn't see what I would get out of it, honestly, because I went to CES to look at the toys, and you can't really look at the toys online. I mean, they're there, but you can't, like, ooh, look at that. Oh, look at that, you know.
I understand.
But I was at CES last year, and there was this shopping cart following this dude around, and then there was this company that was building autonomous package carrying vehicles, and especially in the shape of an airline baggage carrier. And I thought to myself, well, there's another career that's going to be replaced by robots. 10% of American jobs are going to be replaced by robots. What are the jobs that we're going to be replacing them with? I know a lot of people who are employed in airline handling, package handling, mainly because I've spent so much time in airports. It is concerning a little bit to me how little prepared we are, and how maybe we should have had a front runner who was more looking forward to that eventuality. But I'm perfectly glad with the choice of the American public made for its leadership this time around. But are we prepared for robots?
Well, I would suggest that CES is not the place to go for a realistic view of the near term in most technologies. So it is crawling with robots and gadgets and things like that. But most of them are things that we will not see in the main for quite some time. And autonomy has been a category that has been overhyped for years. The bubble's finally starting to pop into some sort of reality, but we've gone from we're all going to be driving or not driving autonomous cars within a few years to no, this is actually going to take longer. It is a technology issue, but it's also potentially a policy issue. It is not yet, but it could be. And so far, it makes more sense in many ways to add autonomy features to transportation rather than whole cloth try to convert them. So we see that in things like bus pilot programs that use autonomy to do the docking maneuver, specifically the bit about pulling into the bus station at exactly the right distance to the curb so that you don't cause any sort of damage. You're close enough to the curb, you don't have ADA and access issues for disabled, all of those things. And yet it's also the most stressful maneuver for the drivers themselves. So it doesn't eliminate the driver. It just helps alleviate one particular aspect of the route for that driver. So there's a lot of these types of examples we'll see that don't eliminate jobs, but they potentially make jobs easier. And if we're all honest, we've been automating features of manufacturing and other things for decades. Robots have been going into car plants, things like that. It hasn't eliminated a category of jobs, but it certainly evolves how they're done, and that will continue to happen. And yes, that will mean some shifting from one center of jobs to another. But it's not, as much as it feels like this is like bright and shiny and happening all at once when you go to CES, this is a much longer, slower process that does require thought, but also isn't hugely threatening next week. I mean, it's that balance of things are happening, and yes, we should prepare, but we should not get overexcited in either direction, either in fear or in, you know, being so excited about, you know, my flying car that's going to come next week. It won't. It may not come in my lifetime, although I would like to be in a Jetsons car one day. But no, I mean, the practicality of how do we make day-to-day life better and easier for everybody and aid jobs, yes, but potentially cleaner jobs. All of these are worthy conversations.
Talking to the team from Postmates at CES, and they had this little car with a smiley face on it.
Yeah, the little robots, yep.
And I said to them, why don't, when that thing's empty, it has to go back home, right? Why don't you put a little arm on it? And then you can grab little plastic bags and aluminum cans and stuff as you're going back. And the plastic it collects, it could melt down and make new little Postmates robots. And they said, we thought about it. And that was the end of the conversation.
I think it's a great idea. I'm not sure about melting it down into new Starship robots, but certainly cities have some power here, and things like that could be conditions of allowing permits for these things to operate on the streets is also providing some public good. This is not a unidirectional conversation. I mean, as much as Uber and Lyft and certain companies have grown big and, you know, sort of they're celebrities in their own right as companies because Silicon Valley and whatever values we attach to that, this is a bi-directional conversation between cities and these providers, between people and their cities. We all need to use our voices more in about the things that we care. And vote, certainly voting is one way, but go to your city council meeting because all of these things come before that council or its equivalent in other areas to get approval. And hearing from citizens is a useful thing. Usually the only people that show up to city council meetings and things like that, or CARB meetings for that matter, are those that oppose. There's not a lot of folks that show up in support of the good things that are happening, and cities do need to hear more of that. And whether it's physically, certainly one benefit of the pandemic is that open access rules have put a lot of these things on Zoom or some other equivalent so that people can participate from their homes. And that allows more folks access to weigh in on these decisions. And there is a certain amount of, we can't just point fingers, but take some responsibility ourselves to at least weigh in on the things that matter before we just go, oh, well, so-and-so is stupid and this guy's an asshole. No, it's on us to also be a part of it, at least in our local area. You're laughing because I cursed.
Well, no, I'm laughing because I can be the asshole sometimes, but
we okay. We all can. That's the point. We're all humans.
There are electric vehicles and then there's Tesla. And I asked Joel about this as well. Of course, he had to be more political because he's the president of a nonprofit. He can't be for or against a single brand. But is it difficult sometimes when you have a conversation about electric vehicles, which does include Tesla, but also may not necessarily include Tesla?
Yes, I understand. You can, I mean, obviously, we can't talk about EVs without including Tesla. At the same time, not everything has to be about Tesla uniquely. And there are certainly folks that believe that there is no EV ecosystem outside of Tesla. And I get it, but that's in some ways the difference between an advocate and a fan.
There are on Twitter, all right, I'll bring up something like, oh, well, Tesla wasn't the first company to do insert thing here.
Right.
And then you get kind of is the word.
Oh, yeah. The quickest way to get death threats is to say something like that, in my experience.
It's weird. It's weird to me that you've created a fan base around a product that is supposed to save the world, and yet people treat it almost as if the product itself is an idol. Maybe not going that far, but oh my gosh, there are some very protective people of this brand. But that's not to say that Lamborghini fans or Ferrari fans were any different, but maybe there just wasn't Twitter back in the day.
Certainly social media plays a significant part in some of this, and some of it is the product, some of it is the person. These are places where the Apple comparisons and Steve Jobs comparisons come in handy, where yes, you know, early Apple fans and sometimes still Apple fans are not that different from Tesla fans, and some of them overlap completely. But in the current Tesla case, it is as much about Elon as it is about the product. And there are plenty of Tesla folks that have started to see some of the product issues for what they are, which is not to say that Teslas aren't great, but I don't think there's much dispute that they've had some production quality issues and things over the years, and yet still believe in Elon and what he's about and his mission, and therefore will not deviate from that support. And no one's asking them to. Multiple ideas can exist at the same time. Also, an idea is not responsible for the people who believe in it. And in any faction, there are going to be people that are to a greater or lesser degree on the extreme end of these things. It's not a lot different than general EV people who claim, you know, I stood on a stage once with a well-known EV advocate who said to the audience, if you don't buy an EV, you're all for taking the faces off babies and more. That's a fairly extreme way to express these things, and not one that is likely to engender most people wanting to come into the tent and join you. So certainly communication matters, but some people are hardcore in their specific beliefs, and I get it. And Tesla's done a lot of amazing things. I find it a little quaint now that, you know, getting dubbed as a hater some years ago required nothing more than suggesting they're not perfect. And I've been there, and I've been dubbed a hater. At the same time, with all of the current, you know, stonks and shorting and all, like, these days just suggesting they're not perfect seems really quaint as a way to be dubbed a hater compared to some of the things happening now. But I mean, they get credit for lots of things in my book. They just don't get credit for all of the things. And we have to figure out a way to have a conversation that is beyond any specific brand, because there is no single car brand for everybody. Setting aside the other modes and the needs there, there is no single car for everybody. Just as back in the day, there were GM people and Ford people, and neither the twain shall mix, there are going to be Tesla people, but also Porsche people. And frankly, I don't care which stripe you are if you come to the party. The single biggest step is to get someone to adopt something with a plug versus something that goes to a gas station. It does not matter that much which one they pick, because all of the data shows they only go more electrified from there, and very few go back. So whatever gets you to the party, if it's a used Nissan Leaf with 30 miles, I'm not going to be the one shitting on you going, shame on you for not getting a Tesla. And I get that some will, but that is counterproductive, and those people are not helpful to where we're all trying to go.
There's also the payment plan involved, and I'd rather own my vehicle than possibly have it taken away one day by this guy who I think is stealing it and turns out to be a repo guy. I've never bought a brand new vehicle. I don't think I'm going to.
Fine. And that's not a Tesla issue. There are plenty of used Teslas, and I know many people who've gotten them that way. So that's not a Tesla problem. But yes, there are a bunch of subjective reasons for which anybody chooses the particular vehicle they choose. Tesla is really compelling. I think they get absolute credit for creating something that has been beautiful and has been very aspirational. They've captured lots of hearts and minds toward EVs, even among people who cannot afford them and may never drive one. That's all good. I think they also don't get enough credit for the over-the-air updates and the ways in which they have conditioned the market to expect that an EV might do something tomorrow it didn't do yesterday. And I'm watching lots of automakers have to try to respond to that. There are other ways in which they are given too much credit. And certain, you know, the only reason GM made the Volt, or the Bolt rather, sorry, is because Tesla. And no, especially at that time, Chevy wasn't sitting there wringing their hands over what GM or what Tesla was doing. So there are things that go too far in terms of giving Tesla single-handed credit for everything. But there are ways in which they should be recognized in terms of generating enthusiasm. And they might, you know, develop a broader product line that ultimately more people will own, but they get a significant amount of the market now. And yet they also rely on incentives and infrastructure and other things that would never exist and will not continue to exist for them alone. So other players are needed, and other players being successful are needed. And so as much as the history has kind of been revised to be, you know, Elon rooting for all other EVs to enter the market, that hasn't generally been the case as much, but more successful EVs is only good for everybody.
So what do you drive?
I still have my 17-year-old Saturn, but we also got a Bolt last year.
Okay.
Personally, I drive very, very little. I put 1,000 or so miles on my car every year, so it doesn't really justify getting any new car, but we did get a Bolt last year for my husband, who was commuting at the time before pandemic.
So you did start at Saturn. That was your first.
I did. I started selling cars in a dealer, in general gas cars, at 17 before EV1 came along. And the Saturn I have is the last one I bought with my company discount. But it's really fun to drive and it does the job. So, and I like small cars. There are not that many small EVs that work well and are affordable. So we got a Bolt when it came along. But even something like the Model 3 for me is bigger than I would want. And my husband worked for Tesla for 5 years. So we had roadsters in our garage quite often and early Model S's, but so far the stuff that Tesla makes is still too big for me.
How about that Honda E though? That looks amazing.
That is literally the car I lust after the most. There is a Model 1 behind me on the shelf. I know.
I see it.
Yep. So yes, I would love a Honda E.
And Johnny did an amazing review of the Honda E.
He did.
That brings me around to Johnny Smith, of course, from the formerly of Car Pervert, now Late Break Show. And before it was called Late Break Show, he was at Fully Charged, and it was still called Car Pervert. Fully Charged. That's a roundabout way of saying, how did you get involved in Fully Charged?
That was an interesting roundabout. Johnny Smith is awesome. And he's always jealous because he wants an EV one more than anybody and thinks that I can like put one on a ship to England for him. I've known Robert since he was doing Carpool, which was a precursor interview show. So comedians and cars and all of that, Robert pioneered that format too. And so he did many of these interviews, which were basically, he'd drive around with somebody and talk to them about what they did. And he came to the US on one trip, probably, gosh, 13, 14 years ago now. A while back, we're all very old. I was one of the people that he interviewed right after Who Killed came out. And so we met then and we stayed in touch. And he called me up a couple years ago and said, I was scheduled to do this Lucid episode like next week. And I've had something come up and I know you live in California. Could you fill in? And being the shy, not really embracing the camera person, that's not my natural habitat. But I said, okay, fine, yeah, I'll try it. And I have become kind of the US presenter ever since. Although I think we're up to 7 or 8 presenters now around the world. And I'm the only one without professional presenting experience. And that generally shows. So I just show up and nerd out and get enthusiastic with folks about what they're doing and go from there.
I actually think you do perfectly great on those episodes. I saw the one from Austin where you're like, hey, that's cool. I really like that episode.
You're very kind. And so are our editors. But no, it's very fun. And I think I've done 8 or 9 of them now. We're starting to plan. It's been really hard to film during the pandemic, but we're starting to plan a couple as we speak. So yes, that's been lots of fun. And of course, we got to do the first American Fully Charged Live last February. It was like the last thing most of us did before lockdown. And so that was absolutely fantastic. Obviously, Robert got sick and he was very bummed, but we carried on and everybody was amazing. And it's all kind of a blur of joyous activity through that whole weekend.
What Dan told me is that maybe Robert won't go to the next American one because they're trying to reduce their carbon footprint. They're trying to reduce their airplane travel. And I'm like, no, he has to come. That's what it is. It's Robert until it isn't Robert, you know? We'll all pay. I'll pay for his carbon footprint. We'll all plant the tree.
Oh, yes. No, I am acutely aware of how many people came to see Robert last February and were very disappointed when they saw me instead of him for most of it. So I am all for him showing up next time. But I get it. I mean, certainly that is a consideration of picking and choosing the valuable travel. And part of it will come down to when we actually can do the next Fully Charged Live. We've pretty much given up on 2021 in Austin, but we have tentative dates for 2022. And I think we're pretty optimistic about that being able to happen. So I imagine we'll talk Robert into it in the meantime, but we have time, I guess. We have a year or so to talk him into it. So maybe we'll start a campaign of everybody, you know, rooting for Robert to come. Because otherwise they'll be stuck with me again and we can't have that.
I wanted to go. I really wanted to go. I actually had my ticket. I paid my $50 ticket or whatever. And I was planning on it. I had a place to stay. But our vehicle just wasn't done yet. And then COVID happened, of course, and I don't even know when it'll get done. My personal car isn't done and our team car isn't done.
No, I understand. It was really, really fun. And I had an extra highlight in that I flew to Oklahoma, and then we road tripped with the EV1 that ended up landing in Austin. So we towed it down there with an Audi e-tron, so an EV towing an EV, and that was incredibly fun.
What do you call that color of green? Is there like a, was there a specific like shop color that you
used? Oh, that was dark green. The EV1 came in three colors: red, dark green, and silver blue. We didn't get fancy, but also, so the EV1 it's the only car in GM's history to only ever have the blue square GM badge on it. It didn't have a Saturn badge or anything else. And it was originally intended to go through the Cadillac dealers because that was kind of the demographic. Not unlike today, the EV buyers at the time were imagined to be wealthy middle-aged white guys, if we're candid about it. And that's generally what they were. So Cadillac in theory, but Saturn was the one that was the best known for great customer service and introducing new ideas to the public and things like that. So it went through Saturn. And Saturn had two things. It had model monikers, like the way they named their cars was two letters and a number. So the sedans were SL12, the wagons were SW12. Therefore, the Impact became EV1, and they weren't fancy with their colors. They were red, green, blue, purple, whatever. So they weren't like, oh, Glacier silver. None of that happened at Saturn. And so EV1 followed suit.
You know what I think would make the perfect electric vehicle is that 1960s Corvette with the slit on. It looks so beautiful going down.
Well, and there are an increasing number of shops that specialize in converting classic iconic cars.
EV West, Stealth EV,
Moment Motors. Yeah, EV West specializes in Volkswagen. Moment Motors does a variety of things, and they actually also came to Austin because they're based there. But yeah, there's a bunch of them now.
Let's not leave out Hawkeye Innovations LLC. I'm not sure if you're aware of Adam Lansing. John Whalen's protege, actually. I had him on the on an episode of this podcast. So every time this conversation comes up, I have to throw his name out there. Yeah.
Well, yes, there is a deep Washington connection to original EVs.
And that's what I said.
And John Whalen is an icon.
That's what I said on LinkedIn.
I know. I saw that. So, yes, I posted an article from AutoWeek, which was great. Mark Vaughn is awesome. And so he dug into basically a few of the people behind Tesla. And in any article, you can only cover so much. So right. Yes, there's no way to cover absolutely everybody that was involved. But yes, John Whalen and Mozilla. And yes, there's lots of
it was a beautiful things. Article. It was amazing. And the fact that people still are bringing back Alan Kekkonen and all yes. of these guys from the old day. You know,
yeah. I mean, it was funny. He sent it to me and he's like, I'm sure you're the only one that will read this or care about it. And I'm like, I will prove you wrong. So I posted it. And of course, lots of people are interested in the history of Tesla, but also just in general, it's really nice to see the OG folks get their due, especially some of the ones that were doing the work before there were things like social media and documentaries made and all of that. So I'm a firm believer in how much electrification has been a really community-oriented effort. It's always been the community and the enthusiasts pulling the industry into the space and leading the way. And we all stand on the shoulders of others. So everyone that sort of thinks that like Elon was the first one to come up with an electric car. It's like, no, here's a whole bunch of people that came before. And that doesn't diminish the credit Elon gets for helping to make it successful. Again, two things can exist at the same time. These innovators absolutely help pioneer the way. And even Elon talks about how he was inspired by EV1, which also came from Alan Kekkonen and a few of the others. And so these things are all very intertwined. And the more those things are recognized, the better for everybody getting into this space now, for sure. Because just as it's not Mary Barra going, we're going electric, make it so, or Carlos Ghosn at Nissan or whoever, it's everybody beneath them that actually do the work. And they very rarely get credit for it, and I always love it when they do.
I don't know if Carlos Ghosn is the name to bring up right now.
He absolutely gets credit for the Nissan Leaf.
Okay.
I mean,
Okay.
I understand all of the controversy since he's a spirited man, but there is no question that he's the one that said we're going electric and absolutely helped protect. And Andy Palmer, who was the number two at the time, and the reason that Nissan was in our second movie, then went to lead Aston Martin. Those guys helped protect the Nissan Leaf for years from all of the bean counters in the company that wanted to kill it. So for all of his other sins, perhaps, and all of those are yet to be litigated, from an EV perspective, both of those guys were good things.
So he's not on the run anymore right now, right?
Well, based on the news reports, he seems to be pretty comfortably ensconced in Lebanon, which is his home country. Okay.
Yeah.
But just as, you know, Roger Smith, Roger and me, has some checkered past, he also pioneered Saturn and championed EV1 and announced that they were going to make it. So as with many humans, there's rarely a situation where somebody is all good or all bad.
Trevor?
You know, I think the jury's out there. He definitely talks well and enthusiastically.
Yeah, I met him. He was cool. He was cool.
I don't know him. I can't. Other than sort of the news stuff, I don't know Trevor Milton. Certainly, yeah. There. But look, there's no shortage of startup companies led or pioneered by guys that have various motivations. So even if he turns out to be what people speculate, he's not alone in our space. There's plenty of them.
Going on to that theme of good and evil in the world and various shades. The minerals that we get to make vehicles, any vehicle, not just electric vehicles, but since there are more minerals involved in electric vehicles, the supply chain is complex. And I am planning on doing an entire episode on minerals, maybe even several episodes on the different metals and minerals that we get, because what I keep saying is my personal motto of sustainability. You can't, on your journey to make the world better, you can't fuck anyone over in the process. And
you try not to, at least.
Yeah. And then you learn that the companies that have been the minerals and mining industry for as long as petroleum products have been around, they're still the companies that are digging for minerals and metals. And there are a lot of negative associations with these companies, especially Glencore. God, how that company still exists is beyond me. I'm not sure if you remember this. You were definitely around.
That's a nice way of saying I'm old.
No. You were born 29 years after my father. So.
Thanks for that.
But the last day of Bill Clinton's presidency, he pardoned this guy named Mark Rich.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if everyone listening remembers, but Mark Rich started this company called Mark Rich & Co., which is now called Glencore, which is led by now Ivan Glasenberg. And as my Freudian slip with Jordan Brompton, I called him Ivan Assenberg, which is probably more appropriate. He lives in this town in Rüsselsheim. I don't know if that's how it's pronounced, in Switzerland. I just feel like he gets away with it. He gets away with so much. Every country from here to fucking Australia has litigated him, and he's somehow gotten away with it because his company's so fucking big. It's on all five continents. There's more ships in their fleet than the British Navy, which is something that any journalist who researches Glencore wants to bring up. They have more ships than the British Navy. How do they get away with it? And that's a big that's a big thing in my head. These past few few months since I've been researching Glencore. I actually joined the London Metals Exchange to learn a little bit more about the process of getting metals and minerals. And I learned, oh, hey, by the way, they're one of the 13 board members on cobalt, among other metals. And so they get to dictate the price along with those other 12 members, except for the one member of the board who is actually part of the LME. So it's 12 plus the observer member. And another one is Tesla, by the way. And so these companies are dictating the price of the metal that they basically have the market on. It's confusing how unfair our justice system has treated Glencore. And when I say unfair, has not prosecuted enough for crimes. And what Dan Caesar brought up when I was talking about this is that Volkswagen committed crime, but they also still made a good product. They make electric vehicles now. As a result,
they have been punished to the tune of $20 billion or so in the US alone.
So this culture of good and evil, how do we justify something with a skateboard that has kind of that rocky history? And when I say rocky, the pun is intended.
No reasonable advocate would suggest that EVs are a free lunch, full stop. There is no perfect solution. And yet, we also can't use the fact that they are not perfect to justify not doing anything. So it's incumbent upon us to try to prevent whatever downsides and unintended consequences we can. We also can't sit still just in case something imperfect might happen, especially when the relevant example is internal combustion. So all of these are fair questions, things we should wrestle it with. I love going to the Nordic EV conference in Norway because they're so much further than us in a lot of ways. They're Europe in general, like they're not debating climate change. This is a foregone conclusion, an accepted topic. And their panels are things like the ethics of battery mining, which are topics that we need to get to. No question. But we cannot let a few examples of bad actors justify not doing the entire thing.
What would be a good degree for somebody if they were interested in electric vehicles? If one of the freshman members of my club, say, for example, was thinking about their future, was thinking about what paths and avenues they wanted to take, maybe they wanted to get involved in electric vehicles, what's a good degree?
I think it depends. There's a lot of them. I think it depends on their particular interest within that. Certainly engineering, mechanical, electrical, et cetera, are useful, but I'm frustrated by the notion that those are the only things that are relevant. Policy, marketing, business, communications, all of these things are relevant in the electric vehicle world, just as they are in the broader automotive and business world. And heck, my degree is in deaf studies. I was still in college when I started working on EV1. In fact, it was one of two deals I made GM promise me upon taking the job. I will not quit school for you people, and I will not move to Michigan. They said yes to both, and so I said yes to EV1. So I finished the degree I was already working on. My intention was to be a sign language interpreter. It turns out I like electric cars more than anyone rightfully should, electric transportation. And so I fell in love with something better and continued to do it. I am also proof that your degree topic is not necessarily relevant in the long run, although it was also largely communications and other things that have come in handy. If you know for sure this is what you want to do, pick some domain that is likely to be applicable. But in the long run, what you studied is not necessarily a hindrance to what you want to do if you find something later.
What do you fear most about the future? And as a follow-up to that, what are you most hopeful for?
I don't fear a lot, but I will say the thing that concerns me most about this topic in the future is complacency. Is the number of folks that think this is all good and fine and we can all go off and do something else. we've made that movie before. And what I'm most hopeful about is how much this has always been a community-led technology and movement and continues to be. So it's never been dependent on exactly what the auto industry wants to do, for example. It has been dependent on the nature and momentum of everybody else involved, all the other stakeholders, but also even the enthusiasts and drivers and folks that decided they wanted to be the ones to tell the story rather than let it go untold. All of those things are the things that should provide us all optimism on this topic, but on most others.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you very much for listening to another episode of Pterodactyl. It was fun. Chelsea is really awesome. I'm so glad we got this one out, and I hope to do many more interviews this academic year. Kitty Adams, Greg Coles, Grant Chaps, Jim Jensen, Carl Popham, Greg Knight, they're all on my list to badger about getting an interview this year. And yes, I'm trying to get an interview with Bobby Lulu, who made a boo-boo, but be patient. For now, you'll just have to settle with the other two presenters that I've already had on the show from Fully Charged. And yes, that series of episodes that I mentioned on minerals and mining is in the works, but won't be ready for a couple of months yet. And I want to ask all of you, is there anything that you would like to hear us cover in these episodes? Maybe someone that you think we should interview? If anyone knows Elon, that would be cool. Give him a shout out for me, will you? I want to leave you on a happy note. Dream big. Work hard and we'll get there. You know that, right? We'll get there. We will. And believe in us. And now, it's time for me to jet. I've got about a 30-page paper to read this weekend. And some drawings to finish. And remember, drive on, young people. Drive on.